This is the PubRight Podcast, a service of the Arbortex community.
We've got Chris Mackler from Applia today. They are doing fantastic and amazing things with the Arbortex interface and with education and learning. Chris.
Hey.
Tell us about Applia and what you're doing.
Sure. So Applia is an education technology company. We were founded by Paul Romer, who's at Stanford. He's an economist. And he had wanted to automate or to bring into the digital sphere some things that he was doing in his own classroom at Stanford and make that available to people more broadly. So it started out as being sort of classroom games, and you could have a couple hundred students online at the same time trading in a market. And what we've become over the past, 8-9 years is primarily a course solutions company. So, and a big part of that is producing online automatically graded homeworks. So people thought that the online experiments were great for econ classes, but then they said, you can do more things online. Can I have problem sets that are graded? And we started doing, problem sets that would, automatically grade people. And they went way beyond multiple choice questions. They went into things where you were graphing, students would graph data, they would manipulate graphs, they would, interact with these things, and it was all done in Flash. We were acquired by Thomson Learning, who's now Cengage Learning, in, 2007, I guess it was. And they said, we love what you've done for economics, now do it for everything else. So we're in the process of expanding very, very rapidly. And in the process, our authoring process, which used to be very handmade, we would type out things in Microsoft Word, type out problems, say, I joined as an economist. I'm an economist by training. I don't have a computer background. Mm-hmm. We started out where the people writing the problems would write them in Word, and then they would hand them to production people who would then make the magic happen. And gradually we realized that in order to scale, we were going to need to have a much more robust feature-filled authoring environment. And we started looking around, and that's how we came to find Arbortex.
Interesting. So you were, that must have been painful, writing out things by hand and then hand coding it into Flash.
Yeah, especially since it was the same person who was hand coding it each time. Now it's actually not hand coding into Flash. It's hand coding into XML. Hang on a second. I'm going to quit my Outlook. I didn't realize Outlook was still on, but I keep hearing it beep, and that can't be a good thing. So sorry.
That's all right. We'll edit that out.
Exactly. Hide when minimize. I just want you to quit. Why won't you quit? I have. Come on. Maybe maximize it. Show new mail desktop alert. How about let's take that off? Okay. Cool. Okay. All right. So sorry to break the flow, but I figured you want to do do every.
I can't hear
you
it.
Couldn't hear it. Oh, I'm sorry. And I could have just been. Alrighty. Well, now we've just lost 2 minutes of our lives. So where were we?
Well, so
it must
the
have been
process you had before.
Yeah. So the process before was it was somewhat painful. What I was going to say is it was not writing directly for Flash. So the Applia problem engine, which is called Q&A, takes an XML file and then renders it within Flash. So that's a proprietary Flash environment, but what it's reading is an XML file. So what we needed to produce was an XML file. We started out by just hand coding them, and that was when we were only doing a couple a week. That was fine. To give a sense of scale, just last week we published over 11,000 problems. So,
wow.
The one person doing that
would
not have been able to do that. So that was one thing, was that it was just work to take the Word document and put it into the XML. The other thing, which is a little bit subtler, was the author, when they wrote in Word, and then the manuscript reviewer, when they looked over the Word document to provide feedback, they couldn't see what it actually looked like online. So the author had something in their mind, the manuscript reviewer had some understanding of what was going to happen, but they were looking at it not in its final form. So there was a little bit of a, what would it really be like to, for a student to take this? And about half of the comments I got were, does the student see this now, or do they only see it after this other part? Because if they only see it now, then it's fine to ask, but if they only, you know, so there was a lot of explaining back and forth, and because what we were writing wasn't in its ultimate medium, it was difficult for people to understand what was going to be happening down the line. So those were the two sort of levels of difficulty. One, there was just the effort at converting it, and that was, you know, a pain and expensive. And the other was, it was pretty late in the process where somebody who was writing for an online platform would actually see what it would look like online. And Arbortext has helped us to solve both of those issues. Now, because we've developed a sort of word processor-like environment in Arbortext where we've used a lot of styling and some Java customization to make it look, you're editing an XML document from the beginning. And then it goes through an XSLT, actually a series of XSLTs to be ready for the Flash environment. And by the time it's, and that used to be that manual process of entering it in and making changes and things like that. And by automating that and by being in a native XML environment from the very, very beginning, we're able to have authors preview what their work is going to look like from the moment they start writing. And that's just a huge advantage to us.
That's nice. Yeah. Being able to do that sort of pre-production preview of this is what it's going to look like must be tremendous for them.
Well, it's tremendous, and it also means that the quality of the work that we've produced has been much higher. Because there's a lot of things that until they're on the screen, you just don't see and you're not able to catch. You can write questions that are much too long. You can write questions that are too short or oddly worded. Just seeing the layout on the page, just having the exercise of going through and having to type in the right answer and make sure that it's correct, just those things were catching bugs much earlier in the process than we would. It's a little bit like having people. So the transition to Arbortext was certainly rocky. It's a little bit like people who are used to picking up a telephone and saying, you know, connect me to, you know, my friend. And all of a sudden you put this, you know, dial pad in front of them and you're like, okay, you have to look up the person's number and then dial the number. And it's going to be 7 digits. But if it's long distance, it's going to be 10 digits. And if it's international, you're going to have to put a 011 in front of it. And they're just like, oh my God, you know, I can't deal with this. This is impossible. How could anybody deal with that? And of course, we all grew up dialing our own phones. But there was, you know, a transition in you know, for people using the telephone, there was a transition where people really hated dialing their own phones. There was also an earlier transition where I know we're totally off topic here, but one of the earliest people who was explained the telephone and you know he sort of said indignantly, what, it rings and you answer it like a servant? And that's so very true now, isn't it? but yeah, so the transition to Arbortext was definitely difficult. You know, people in working in Word was familiar to them. They could write things in Word. They could write down what they meant. They could put a little bit of a note. I would like this to do such and such, and then the producer would make it do such and such.
Right.
So that was a little bit difficult. More difficult than that was figuring out how to work with XML files for people. So, and working in a shared environment. So back when it was a Word manuscript, people could sort of do whatever they wanted with the Word document. They could save it wherever they wanted on their desktop. They could email it back and forth. They could mark it up. They could change its name. They could do whatever.
Right.
Once they were dealing with what would become the ultimate problem from the beginning, we had to have a content management system. We use Subversion as our mm-hmm. repository. So there was a lot of, it has to be at this specific location on your disk or else this is going to work. And, you know, you've got to set this up and you've got to install this program on your computer. And ArborText didn't install for a lot of, we've had a lot of problems with with Vista. We've had a lot of problems with 64-bit, let alone Mac, since it doesn't run on a Mac. So we've got to get people working in Parallels and all of this kind of thing. So there's this sort of initial setup cost with ArborText, but once people are in it and once they're using it, then the actual using of the ArborText problem is usually pretty far down on their list of complaints. They have other complaints, but they have mostly to do with what they're doing in ArborText, not the program itself.
Right, right. That is very, very common, and it's not unique to the folks you're dealing with. Even, you know, your greatest technical writers who spent their lives growing up with FrameMaker or Word never saw, for example, WordPerfect, where you had to go in and dig at the codes because it didn't quite do the right thing and you needed to tweak it, move it around. You know, they're like, whoa, you really had to do that ever?
Yeah.
Right. So it's not, you know, it's not an unusual thing, and it's not limited to ArborText. It's just a lot of that, you're right, has to do with going to XML and a structured thing that before you could kind of do whatever you wanted, and now you've got a rigid structure that needs to fit.
But the truth is that what they were writing had to fit into a rigid structure eventually. Mm-hmm. So it had to be XML eventually. And in fact, it you know, a lot of what people found when they moved from Word to XML was they were like, well, I really want to do that. And I'd be like, well, you weren't supposed to be doing that in the first place, and we were always correcting it. So it was never actually making it to production the way they had done it. One thing that we found is that we initially used ArborText to edit the same kind of XML as goes into the Flash player. And that lasted about half an hour because what goes into the Flash player is essentially telling a renderer how to render it. But that's not the way authors think. Authors think, I want to have a paragraph of text, or I want to have a picture that does the following thing, or I want to this is going to be, the classic example, the correct answer in Applia was controlled by an attribute called the key. And you had to set the key equal to 1 for a correct answer and key equal to 0 for an incorrect answer. And then it was all scrambled before any student could see it. Mm-hmm. ArborText, in the ArborText environment, instead of choosing option and then setting your key, we set up a new element called correct.
Right.
Authors find it a lot easier to insert an element called correct than to insert an element and then choose the attribute that represents what that element, how that element is being used. So we do so our authoring XML is geared towards, creating an experience for the user being the author that makes it, friendly and natural to write in, whereas the runtime XML, runs the code that makes things that delivers it to the student.
Right, and so you've got an XSL pipeline converting one to the other.
It's a combination of XSL and Java. So there are some things that that XSL is able to do, and then Java does the really heavy lifting.
That's great. Wow. So tell me a little bit about, and you customized the interface.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And I did it. And since I have no sort of background in this kind of thing, so that attests to how easy it is to customize the interface. So there's two ways in which we customize the interface. One is just using a style sheet that would make the Three ways. Sorry, nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition. Three ways we customize the interface. The first was just through a style sheet. We make the correct answers green. We make the incorrect answers red. We make radio buttons look like radio buttons. We do that kind of thing. The one area that we found it very difficult to deal with a style sheet is in tables. That it's very, the moment we had custom tables, we weren't able to allow the user to, change the widths of columns and things like that. And that was that was really, really very difficult. The second way that we customized the interface is that we created a new menu called the Q&A authoring menu, which essentially runs various Java things. So under the Q&A authoring menu, we have, for example, a preview this problem in a browser. And what that does is it takes the document you're looking at, it fires up Firefox, and it gives you and it shows you what this will look like in runtime. And people use that all the time. Here locally, everybody has two monitors set up, and almost always, if you just walk around, what you'll see is on the left-hand monitor you see ArborText, on the right-hand monitor you see a browser, and so they're constantly sort of re-updating what's in the browser from ArborText.
Nice.
The third way that we customized was to create some GUI interfaces. We found those very cumbersome to create. They took a long time to get the interface right, and in some cases, we weren't ever able to do exactly what we wanted with them. Case in point, for example, we have a really neat one that creates, and we call these things factories. So basically what they are is you insert an element, it calls up a GUI interface, and it says, what would you like to do? You fill out a little form, and then it creates that XML for you. Then it goes away. It's never there anymore. It's basically a way of creating a mini customized template. One of these was for truth tables in logic. So a problem in which you give somebody a logical statement across the top, and then they have to evaluate for each character in that statement whether it's true or false. And those characters can be letters, but they can also be logical symbols. And it so happens that in the GUI interface, you can't actually type in logical symbols. They just appear like boxes. So what the logic writer does is he writes out the thing in ArborText, because ArborText will deal with it fine. So he uses the symbols in ArborText and then just copies it and pastes it into the GUI interface.
That's weird.
We found it also took weeks to develop that interface. What we're leaning toward now is a Flex-based environment in which we have quick tasks that alter the XML, and which we can use to create things, to manage files. It's basically an in-house, very highly customized CMS. So instead of altering things within ArborText, we are altering them outside of ArborText when a really elegant UI is called for, because Flex is just insanely easy to develop things quickly in.
Right. I don't know Flex.
Flex is a I'm going to reveal the total ignorance of me, but it's a programming language published by Adobe, and it's essentially Flash based, and Flash and XML based. So you can, and it sort of looks a little bit like Java, but it's very event driven. It's a little bit like ACL that way, but it's incredibly friendly, and you can develop things extremely quickly that have a very elegant UI, and it has lots of UI controls within it. And it's just very, very easy to develop. And the language, put it this way, the language is simple enough that I've been able to teach it to myself. with some help from the other, props to the rest of the content engineering team. But I've actually managed to write some code in it. Actually, the rest of the content engineering team taught me how to use it. I should not say that I taught myself how to use it, but I have fumbled around in it with the aid of others, and it was fairly easy.
So tell me about your team.
So our team has expanded extremely rapidly, in part because we were able to show that we were producing extremely high quality work, I think. So we started out with just three of us initially, myself with a content background, Matt Ansel, who was our content producer, who was the one who was, lucky enough to be the one coding in from Word into XML, lo those many years, and then David Murphy, who's an engineer here and who is now our head of engineering. So that was the initial sort of team, and with just the three of us, we were able to get ArborText up to a very good level. In the last year, we have hired like crazy. It's now myself, Carl Liu, who's a fantastic engineer and guru of all things programming, and he's so he and I are the architects on the project. We have Chris Miller, who spends about half his time on the Applia platform, and then the other half of his time with the content engineering team. Do you want people's names, or you just want people what the composition?
Whatever you want to. Whatever you want to. Whatever you want to talk about. Like if it'd be good to sort of know also sort of what they're doing, how you're putting your team together to support what you're doing.
Sure. Okay. So the current team is myself, Carl, Chris, Selena Zhang, who's another content engineer, and then we have three content producers. So Matt, who I mentioned before, Megan Keith McFarland, and Jennifer Rowatt. And so we have a team of basically two architects, an engineer, another engineer who splits his time between us and another project, three content producers, and then we also have a QA person who again splits her time between. So that's Valentina, who splits her time between the platform team and the content engineering team. So Applia itself now has sort of two engineering teams, one of them dealing with the platform and one of them dealing with content engineering.
So do you all write the questions, or you get them from an external source?
Oh, okay. So the authoring is done by an in-house team of content authors and editors. And so the team that I was describing was just the people who are working in ArborText on the authoring interface. So that was the team of engineers.
Okay.
In addition to that, we now have, I think the size of the content team is about 60 people. Who are they are people who, like me, are academics and who write questions. There are editors, there are copy editors, there are editorial assistants, there are QA people, there are freelancers, there are manuscript reviewers who are professors who are who just do this as a moonlight type of deal. So all in all, the sort of the user base who's using this stuff is probably at this point roughly 60 people, and we're hiring like crazy as we go into new disciplines. We started out with a when I joined the company, the content team was five people. There was an editor. There were three economists and a producer who would put the stuff into XML. So that was for, and that's about the, it's sort of like a platoon, you know, in the Marines or something. that's about what a discipline is. You have about three writers, you have an editor, you have somebody who sort of helps make everything happen, be it a producer or an editorial assistant. So when I joined, we had just economics. Now we have econ, finance, statistics, accounting, psychology. I mean, you know, we're going into all of these, you know, we're going into four or five new major disciplines per year.
Wow.
And so we're hiring people, training people. Oh, so the other person on the team is – two other people on the team are Misha Berkowitz, who is a – who's our – he's known as our Arbortech specialist. He's sort of a documentation and training person. So he sort of fields questions from this, you know, diaspora of people. And then we have a project manager who helps sort of set our guidelines and work us through sprints and things like that. So and that's usually Jen Sheridan, but she's out on maternity leave right now. Right now that's Erin Tammany.
Right. That's a pretty big team that you all are supporting.
It's big and growing. But, you know, Arbortech is what's allowed us to scale. You know, we've probably quadrupled in the last year, tripled or quadrupled.
Wow. Oh, my God.
And the other thing is that, you know, we started off in very quantitative disciplines, like econ and finance and statistics. As we go into more qualitative disciplines, like psychology and history and business communications, these are... you know, things in which people's training is not as quantitative. So, you know, for the economists, you know, for the economists coming and starting to write in XML, you know, most of the economists coming into the into this had some background in you know, in programming or computers or something. Mm. The person who has, I mentioned logic before, Zach, who's our logic writer, has, you know, he's done things with the XML that I've never seen anybody do. It sort of scares me a little bit.
Wow.
But he's
like
he's
what?
Amazing. Oh, it's just that his questions are sort of randomized, you know, six ways to nowhere. Our content, one of the things that makes the things is the way that we randomize questions. So we actually an Applia problem is not just a single problem. It is any number of different problems that can be asked. And so within each XML document, you have the components to create, you know, sometimes as few as a dozen, sometimes as many as, you know, millions of different kinds of questions, depending upon with, you know, what it is that you're randomizing. And Zach will randomize, you know, the order in which everything appears and which thing, you know, and then he randomizes the explanation to go with it. And it all comes out looking extremely natural. But it's all very, very systematic, but he took it to it like a fish, like fish to water. But you don't want to be constrained to hire people who have a technical background, because in a lot of disciplines people won't have a technical background. Right. And that's just because the discipline isn't as technical, and the tools that we develop should be as good for a technical audience, as audience being the authors, as they are for a non-technical audience. And so we're working to try to improve that.
Nice. And so that's all built into your DTD?
That's largely built into – so the DTD and also the XSLTs. So,
okay.
You know, the Q&A rendering engine that we have is extraordinarily powerful and can do all kinds of things. And some people really like to produce XML that's really close to the runtime XML. That's, you know, where they're controlling the way every single pixel lies and all of this kind of thing. For others, you know, you just want to say, I want to write three versions of this question. So, for example, we introduced an element into the DTD called part variation. And within a part, if you want your part to have sort of three different questions that can pop up, you then put in a part variation element within the part, and then you can just type away, you know, type your question in each of the ones, and it will then choose randomly to show the student one of those three different versions of the question. What that's actually doing is creating what's called a switch element, and the switch element with cases, and you need to establish a random variable which is drawn and then controls the cases and things like this. So you could go in and create the switch element and set up their variables and things like that, but what the XSLT actually does is allows the user to just set part variation and then on the way out creates this additional variable, which then controls this switch. So the user has the ability to go sort of, you know, automatic or stick shift. You know, the automatic way is to do part variation. The stick shift way is to actually program with the elements that are going to be controlling the runtime environment.
Nice that you've got that built out for them to choose which way they're going to go.
Yeah, I mean, it's our object is the sort of mandate that we had from the beginning was we didn't want this new environment to limit what people could do. So they had to be able to do everything that they could do initially. But we wanted to create the ability to have sort of a templatized environment. We use tag templates a lot. Those are great. You know, and the ability to have a templatized environment where people could, you know, say, you know what, I want to create an accounting journal table. Don't let me set all of the things. I just want it to look like all the other accounting journal tables that we have. I don't want to set the widths. I don't want to set the, you know, the whether it's bold or not. Don't want to set any of that. I just want to say, give me a bloody accounting table, and it'll do that. It'll let them do that.
Excellent. Well, so what other kinds of things have you done in what's the most interesting thing that you've done that would be interesting to ArborText implementers or people who are doing things?
I don't know what interesting
I don't know how to ask that question either, you know.
Well, who are the people who use ArborText? Why don't you explain, you know, why don't you describe to me the kinds of people that you have in mind, and I can then imagine what it is that would be exciting.
Well, part of the goal of this podcast series is a lot of ArborText knowledge is tribal. Almost all of it is. Mm-hmm. And we're trying to most of the people listening are those who are implementing or those who are using the product just as writers. Somebody else has implemented something. Mm-hmm. I think other than what Wolters Kluwer is doing, what you all are doing is probably the most customized that I've heard of in a while. Mm-hmm. Actually, because you're doing all kinds of stuff in front of the scenes and behind the scenes and sort of off to the side at the same time.
I think that probably the most, if I could talk to myself of a year and a half ago.
Right. Yeah, let's do that.
It would be to, and I think that you told us this when you came in and you know, and we said, well, we really want to customize the six ways to nowhere. And you said, be careful of the Java customization, you know, because if ArborText changes, then your Java code might need to change or things like that.
Right.
I think that the biggest thing that we've learned is in this past year in dealing with the Flex environment is that there are some, so there's the Flex environment, there's the Java code that we have that runs, and then there is, and then there's ArborText itself. So there's basically three points at which the XML can be edited. One is within the ArborText editor. Right. One is ArborText calls a Java code that then does something to it, runs it through these XSLs and saves it somewhere else. And the third is it's simply operated on by some other program with ArborText completely closed.
Okay.
And I think that realizing which tasks are best suited for each of those three ways of manipulating the XML is the thing that you really want to think about as, you know, like an architect at the very beginning. There are some things that ArborText does really well. There's other things that it really doesn't do well. One of the really frustrating things, and this is something that we had emailed you about a little while ago, was, and again, I'm stepping into the area that I don't know, But there's an issue of DOM 2 versus DOM 3 with XML parsers.
Right.
And when we were developing our XSLT, we would test it in Oxygen, and it would work just fine. And then we would call it from Oxygen, and it wouldn't work. And it was the most frustrating thing in the entire world, because the XSLT in Oxygen was DOM 3. The XSLT when it was run by Arbortext was DOM 2.
We've actually moved
from an environment in which Arbortext calls the XSL to an environment in which the Flex, the Air app calls the XSL. So when we want to, to export a document, we save it in Arbortext. We close it out of Arbortext, and then we transform it using this other tool. And that way, and because this other tool is using DOM 3, it's much more reliable in terms of running the XSLTs.
Got it.
The other thing is that the UI was much easier to develop in Flex than it was in ACL. And so for those tasks which can be run, and a lot of these are also batch tasks, so a lot of them are like, we want to rename the attribute, label space. We want to rename it label width. So what you want to do is you want to open up all of the documents in the following directory and make this transformation.
Right.
Arbortext is not so great at doing that. You need to open them up one at a time, blah, 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 blah. So creating these, this interface that says, for manipulating, large numbers of XMLs simultaneously, is really very, very useful. But I would say that of all of the things, the biggest win has just been to create a menu that says preview this. That says preview this in a browser. So if you like us are creating XML that will be rendered through a browser, the ability to just say preview and have a one-click preview capacity is that has been the biggest single win of this entire project.
Wow, that's great.
So that would be the advice that I would
give to yourself back then
is we actually could have saved ourselves a lot of the prettifying in the manuscript, because a lot of the styling we do in the manuscript is about sort of communicating which part of the problem this is. And the fact that you can just see it right away means that you actually need a lot less of that.
Cool. So where are you going next?
Where are we going next?
What's your next feature that you're looking
at? A lot of development on this Flex Air tool. So there's just a lot of, we are a very highly customized, shop. The other thing that we're hoping to do is we're hoping to use MarkLogic as an XML repository, which will be great. Although there is a conflict between Arbortext and MarkLogic, and a very important one too, which is that Arbortext treats entities as, we do a lot of things with file entities. And when you have a file entity, you say insert file reference, and then it inserts the entity at the top of the at the top of the document. That is not ingested into a MarkLogic repository. I believe that it might not be W3 compliant, though I'm not sure about that. I don't know that the way that it
file entities are SGML, so they are long time old compliant.
Yeah. So I don't know how. I don't know why it doesn't do it, but we have to transform it to get into MarkLogic. But MarkLogic, we're very excited by MarkLogic. We went to their conference. Yeah. They're actually upstairs from us.
Well, I was going to say, they're next door, right?
Yeah. We actually now have more offices. We expanded so fast that we have more offices. So we're on the first floor of their building. They're on the second floor. So we keep wanting to invite them down for pizza. But we were very, very impressed by what we saw at the MarkLogic conference.
Right. Well, and you got Norm Walsh there, so.
And
although he's not local, I think.
I don't know. But they, I think that, building a tool that will allow us to use, to have Mark Logic sitting underneath our repository and using that, we're very, very excited about doing that. And then, sort of using XQuery through this, through this AIR tool to, return, show me all the problems that have to do with such and such, and or go through and change all of these things or whatnot. So we were very impressed with the stuff that Mark Logic was doing at their, their conference, and we're excited to use that. Within ArborText itself, I don't know that we're I think we've got sort of a stable environment. We'd love to be able to learn more about both for our Flash rendering and for our authoring environment, worrying about displayed equations and equation editing, especially equation editing combined with elements that might be part of the equations, like variables, and things like that. Using the equation editor and trying to figure out how to deal with those kinds of things. We'd really like to figure out how to get tables to work right. It's a constant source of frustration to everybody that we can't get the tables to work right.
I wrote that down. I'll do some. I'll talk to you independently, and we'll see if we can figure out what that is.
That would be great. But that's. Yeah. But tables are the hardest of everything, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
that's true.
Are always just really hard. So there's that. And there's a little bit of cleanup around the edges. We haven't, we figured out most things in ArborText by poking around, and there's just some things that I'd like to do to make it look better. I haven't figured out how to allow the user to select a color and then, for some text, and then have the text show up in that color using the styler. I haven't been able to see, using the styler, you can choose what color you would like it to be, and you choose it from a color palette. I haven't been able to see let the color be controlled by the following attribute, although I'm sure that there's a way of doing that. All of these things are so much at the level of just making things pretty that other priorities have taken precedence over them. So that's sort of what's next. But we're I guess the other thing that we are consistently working on is trying to figure out how to make it easier to install ArborText on people's machines. We do a lot with freelancers who are coming on, and we have concurrent licenses so that they can so that they can use the concurrent license when they're working on a project for us. But getting people ramped up really quickly and having things, it's funny whenever I ask people about, what their experience with ArborText is, and they always start out with, it was really hard to install on my computer, or I had to go out and buy another computer because it didn't work on my husband's Vista machine, and so I just bought a computer and expensed it, and things like this. We've wasted a lot of time, a lot of really valuable time. If we have like somebody out for a 1 day, of training, we spend like 2 hours getting their system set up, and that's huge.
Well, don't I have news for you?
Oh, do you have news for me?
Well, with 5.4, there's a new thing called a deployment kit, and you can install it over the web. You put everything you want to have in the installer pack, and you test it for whatever environment you want, and then you have them download it, and it installs, and it requires a concurrent license, which you're using.
Interesting.
And it should be just up and running. I'm trying to set up a video podcast, which we're doing that once a month, with Sam Brow, the engineer inside ArborText, who is leading the development on that project. It was part of 5.4.
Oh, very cool. The other thing that that has always been kicked around, and I'm curious as to what the current status is a web-based ArborText environment. Is that...
That was also... It's an ActiveX control and came out with 5.4.
Okay. So we can actually have people go to a website now and be using... Explain to me how that works.
So it's part of the deployment kit. I don't... we are still learning at it on our own. Also, you know, okay. We're still doing it. But there's a lot of information about, you know, exactly how that works, and it's part of the deployment kit. And actually, I think that's how the deployment kit works.
Okay.
To start.
Interesting.
If
we had freelancers who didn't have to install it on their local machine, then that would be ideal. That would save a huge amount of resources that are being spent to do this. Now, will the ActiveX control deal with styling as well?
It, as far as I know, it's a fully functional editor.
Okay.
There may be some requirements as far as what content management is helpful, let's put it that way. I don't want to say required, but I will say helpful to make it work, right? Because part of it has to do with where are the files and how do you get access to that and how to make the paths all work correctly.
Sure.
We can certainly talk about what those requirements are and give it a shot, see how it works.
That would be great. Awesome.
Yeah. Very cool.
Very cool. Well, I'm glad to learn that.
See? It's fun. I get to provide some use.
Yay!
Cool. Yeah, that's good.
So
excellent.
What else would be interesting for you to know, or does that get enough for you?
Well, you know, I think I'd love to see sort of how your stuff works.
Sure. Do you want to come down here, or do you want to? I can share it on Skype, I guess, but it's probably easier to see it with the big screens and things like that. So.
Sure. Let me set up some time in September.
Okay.
I'm going on vacation.
Ooh, sounds good.
So like September to come down and take a look. I'd love to see it. It's been a year and a half at least.
Indeed, and it's changed a lot.
Yeah.
A lot.
I mean, I thought it was cool then, and now you're doing this and some other things, and you got all these other parts built in, and you're doing 11,000 questions in a month?
In a week.
That's tremendous.
A week.
In a week.
Yes.
Jeez.
Yeah, that was insane. Wow. it's really... You know, if I had to encapsulate what it does really well is it solves our technical issues so that people can be innovative on what they're writing. You know,
that's great.
That's really what it has allowed us to do. And it's been great in that.
Excellent. Oh, that's so good to know.
So
great.
Cool.
All right. Thanks, Chris.
All righty. Thanks, Liz.
All right. I will let you go. And I appreciate your time.
No worries.
This has been fantastic.
Thanks so much. Talk to you later.
All right. Bye.
Bye.
The PubWrite Podcast is a production of Single Sourcing Solutions in San Jose, California. Copyright 2009. Single Sourcing Solutions.